This is Pat McCoy, representing Saginaw Valley College's History Department. This evening, June 7th, 1972, I'm in the home of Mr. Gerald Noe, located outside of Holly, Michigan. Mr. Noe, the retired international representative or District 10 secretary for 22 years for the Pattermakers League of North America, and Mr. Harold Stevens, retired committeeman of said Union of Saginaw, who helped organize the Saginaw area, have graciously consented to participate in an oral history taping entitled The Historical Progression and Regression of the Pattermakers League of North America in Michigan. Emphasis will be given to the impact of relevant legislation upon the league's growth in correlation with the union growth in general. In terms of national labor policy, the American labor movement has gone through three phases. Repression, 1790 to 1930, encouragement, 1930 to 1947, and intervention, 1947 to the present. The AFL, or American Federation of Labor, dominated the American labor movement from its origination by Samuel Gompers in 1886 until a CIO, Committee of Industrial Organization, was founded by John L. Lewis in 1936. The PML, or Pattern Makers League, was founded May 18, 1887. Briefly, what is the PML, and where and by whom was it founded? Mr. Noe?
Well, the PML, or Pattern Makers League, is a group of pattern makers banding together to create conditions for their best interest. Now, the Pattern Makers League was founded in May the 18th, 1887, by full groups of pattern makers around the country from different cities. You understand, the pattern makers, I don't know how long, but they've organized in different cities where the patterns are being made in small groups to go after conditions unified for years longer than I've even been able to find out. But enough of them were organized, and after the American Federation of Labor was founded in 1886, I think prompted the pattern makers to unify internationally as a labor organization. And in 1887, these groups from several cities got together and founded the Pattern Makers League. And ever since that time, various associations and cities around the country where patterns are made have been chartered the Pattern Makers League. Detroit being chartered in January the 4th, 1890, for example, in Michigan. Detroit being the first in Michigan to be chartered. They endeavored to organize around the state various cities where patterns is made, in Saginaw, Grand Rapids, Muskegon, Albion, Kalamazoo, Battle Creek, Lansing. I think that's about gets them all. The Detroit Association endeavored to organize all these places and make them branches of Detroit. And most of them, as I understand, were, and a lot of them still are, branches of Detroit. I understand that Grand Rapids was issued a charter back in either 1934 or 35. Or 33 or 34, I should say. Muskegon and Saginaw were issued charters in the very early 40s. I believe it was 1941 or 2. If I had the minutes of the district here with me yet, I could definitely point out which it was. Now, several of these places, cities, that have very few pattern makers are still branches of Detroit. For example, Battle Creek, Grand Rapids, Battle Creek, Kalamazoo, and Lansing,
Flint.
Pontiac, and Flint are still branches of Detroit. Flint being the only one, I would say, that have enough members, and Pontiac, to comply with the league's, let's say, rules of becoming an association, of having 25 or more members, and they both have more than that.
Well, Jerry, we tried to get Flint in with us at one time. You know, that is a Saginaw association, in order to get a full-time man ourselves, mm-hmm. and that. You remember with Smitty in there? What happened that we couldn't get Flint in there?
I really don't know, Harold. I remember that there was a move on that's been back even before Chevrolet, and I guess afterwards.
After Chevrolet about was 1950.
And I would say this, Harold, that I did at the time tell them what had to be done.
Yeah.
In order to get it, and I was also told by the authorities that it would come from that they didn't believe you'd encounter any trouble doing it.
Yeah.
Because your interests
were
common. Yeah, we sure
did. You know, if we at that time we would have been much stronger if we could have got a, you know, and you were pulling for us, that group in there now. I don't know. I was asking you just where did that hang up go? Because we could have had a full time man there.
I think the hang up was right. In the
Detroit.
two places, not in Detroit, in the two places that they didn't go after.
Oh, I see.
This is, I understand it, because I approached the proper authorities so I wouldn't ill advise you that told that you didn't think that would be any problem.
Yeah, because us belonging to the Detroit Association was a big deterrent. You know, that is to the, and as far as organizing the people went, because as you brought it go, in our off-the-record discussion there, that about the jobbing shops or the various shops would get too much, or like you say, it's ready to crack down. Like Curly Cullum and Saginaw did the same thing. He would bring the work, send the work all out first, you know, and then just have a nucleus of men. And then that work would pile up in Detroit, and they would be getting more men there. Then Curly would start drawing it back gradually, and he worked that in cycles till we'd be filled up in Saginaw. Then we'd have that agitating going on,
and it would
make the local people angry because the work would go back down to Detroit.
And that's the Chevrolet's founder you're speaking of.
That's
now.
Right, yeah.
Harold, this didn't only happen in Chevrolet Foundry. This was a common thing in let's say all the big corporation shops.
Yeah, that was their policy.
And while I wasn't as familiar with it, as much working at the trade as I was talking to the older members who fought these conditions, they would, with the organization they had, they would go after increased rates of pay and working condition in the jobbing industry until the jobbers would be forced to go so far until the corporations wouldn't go any farther, so they wouldn't give them any more work, and they'd pull the men into the corporation shops, and the corporations, and as much as the men were still organized, they weren't all organized, but
yeah,
they had
right.
They could do a pretty good job of keeping the I wouldn't say in all shops, but I happened to work in one shop for 10 years in General Motors, and we kept it 100% organized during the 10 years I was there.
What date was that?
Pardon?
What date was that?
From 1930 until 1940.
Well, if we're going to discuss the company tactics then, the companies use such tactics as blacklisting, lockouts, night riders, yellow dog contracts, and company unions. What type of impact did these tactics have upon the PML?
Well, the pattern makers fought these tactics continuously. In other words, when they'd pull the work into the corporation shops and the corporation and the pattern makers went to work in the corporation shops, they immediately would, in their unified effort, would try to bring up the conditions there. And it was a vicious circle, because normally, and this is more before my time, as it was explained to me when I was a youngster, that when they would get too tough for the corporations, well, they'd send the work out again. Mm-hmm. And it was back and forth. I did happen to work in one shop from 1930 until 1940 that we kept the work in, but when Roosevelt came into office in 1932, up until that time we'd been working 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, straight time, mind you, 8 hours on Saturday, straight time,
mm-hmm.
And if they wanted you to work on Sunday, it was still straight time.
Yeah.
And I was the youngster in the shop, but I was kind of a rebel, and when it come to Sunday, I said, I've had it. I don't want any more of it.
Yeah.
And I'd go home. And the old superintendent in the shop, while he was probably a little different than some of the company superintendents, he was not a union man, but he knew how strong the union was in the shop, and he knew that it meant his job to keep the work in there if he possibly could. This is my own assumption. And he'd play along with the union as far as he could.
Uh-huh.
And he'd say to me, Well, we'll have to send the work out then. Well, let's go ahead and send it out. I'll go out there and make it. This was our general, this was our general attitude all the way through, and this is the way we went through it until I finally quit after 10 years.
Yeah, well, we ran into the same thing at that foundry that we had, Curly Cullum. Now, Curly Cullum at one time was an organizer for the Pattern Makers League in Detroit, they tell me. And they got him up there, and he knew exactly what was going on, and he worked on that cyclic thing. I started there in 1933, and it had built up, and I'm paying my debts that I'd accumulated through the Depression there, and not too interested in the union at all, but there was a union movement, as you say, the Pattern Makers League were moving. In 1935, house cleaning, and they cleaned out, I would say, about 35% of that group. And speaking of that same time, that no overtime, we had no overtime there either, but on nights they let you work an hour longer. Could work an hour longer instead of like now they pay the 5%. You could work an hour longer, same straight time that they give you. The only thing, I was there in 28, and we worked on nights. That's when they were getting ready for the six-cylinder job, you know, that was coming out. I think 29, the six-cylinder Chevy come out. And we worked from 6 at night until 6:30 in the morning. We got paid 12 and a half hours. We said, what do we get, a half hour over that? Oh, no, we pay you for your lunch hour.
Speaking of that, and speaking of 1928, this is about the time I started work in the late 28 or early 29, and I started working in the pattern shop at making pattern. But prior to that time, I was in the pattern department. I'd set up a pattern storage for Pontiac Motor Car Company, and after I got that set up, I didn't have enough to keep me busy all the time, so I went out in the shop and made things, and they had me in the in as much as I could type and do office work, they had me in the office doing office work. So one day I was busy typing something, and the superintendent said to the shop foreman, and this, I'm not sure whether both the metal shop and the wood shop foreman were in there or not, but he, at least to the wood shop foreman, who I know was in there, he said, well, he says, the union's getting too strong in here. We're going to have to drop the axe. And believe it or not, that same night, the axe did drop. They laid off a bunch. And this is rather interesting because I quit Pontiac Motor in late 1929, and as I was going out of the company through the employment office, the employment manager asked me, who is the union representatives over in that shop? I said, I don't know. I'm not a union member. I don't know. Well, that's fine. Coincidentally, the same office employee a few months later got me a job, my next job at General Motors Truck and Coach. I joined the union a very short time later.
Because of need. You both, you gentlemen, have described lockouts very thoroughly, and perhaps a little bit of blacklisting. Steve, would you like to go into a little bit of depth concerning night riders? I hear that they were quite prevalent in Saginaw.
Well, we had the night riders on that. It wouldn't be in a small union as a pattern makers league, but when the UAW first started up, that was in 37, they had the sit-down strikes in Flint, and they'd meet up the auditorium then. They had this fellow by the name, I think, Robbins. They were starting their own union then. The company unions were coming into effect. In fact, they had been in for maybe a year or two, but they had started then, I think they called it the American Labor Party, dues 25 cents a year. Well, then they would get up and a lot of the supervision were up there and say, we'd ride this fellow out of town on a rod. Then they would go around. These night riders for this group were the company night riders. They would go around and beat up on the people that were active in the union or who they thought were active in the union. Eventually it swung around the other way a little bit, and the union guys were going and taking care of those other fellows. But it was common in those days that, you know, if you were active in the union one way or the other, that you're either going to get hurt or you're going to hurt someone else.
I hear that some of the picket signs used a dual purpose. They were a 2x4 with a small index card attached to the top.
Yeah, well, I remember one instance where they weren't 2x4s, they were 2x4s that were split. Then they would put a little sign on it like that. It'd be about 4 foot long, yeah. The handle would be round and smooth, and it was used as well as a billy club could be used.
I understand as well that the shop unions used to use rubber hoses filled with lead so that they wouldn't leave marks on the people. Did you ever run into any such thing as this?
No, I didn't run into anything like that, but in 1937, Smitty was hired for who later became the business agent of the Pattern Makers League. We were laid off at that time. There was no work. They were down in Flint, and the rest of us laid off at Chevrolet Gray Iron. And they hired quite a few of the pattern makers to be more or less plant patrol that would patrol the thing, that is the plant, you know, itself, go completely around over into Carlton and around. And in the foundry, they had somebody had some welded up like a tank, you know, we call it a tank now, this sheet metal stuff, and they even had a firing range down there with this shotgun stuff. But nothing ever happened. I don't think anyone ever carried a gun.
That was merely for intimidation purposes.
I would say yes, just intimidation, and even for the fellas to brag that they were working there, figuring that they didn't know how big a force they had, maybe 50 men.
I see. One last question about this. Mr. Noe, the Yellow Dog contracts that the companies used to have, did you run into this type of thing when you were organizing most of Michigan?
Yes, I did. Not with any union that I offhand recall, but I did in organizing in different shops run into Yellow Dog contracts with the employees, such as you call company unions, what I always referred to them. But insofar as any recognized union, I don't recall ever running into a real Yellow Dog contracts per se.
I see.
But I did run into them, and they didn't hold water when I got ready to petition for the shop.
They were more an intimidating process as well, then.
Well, it was something that the leading the employees to believe they were getting something they really weren't. Mm-hmm. And when I could offer them so much more, it didn't mean too much when it came down to a labor relations board election, and I did have the experience of organizing a lot of different individual shops. I mean, anywhere from 2 or 3 men to 400 or 500.
I see. All right. And until 1932, the hostility of the courts toward labor unions was obvious in the usage of injunctions prohibiting striking or picketing or boycotting. The formal charge they used was the criminal conspiracy doctrine. The question is, was this tactic employed against the PML? And if so, what was the result? Do you recall at any time that we were charged with a criminal conspiracy doctrine violation?
Not since I became active. I have heard older persons than myself tell about these things. But as far as my own personal experience, and that's, as I said a while ago, started in 1928, really, in the pattern shop, I don't recall of any criminal injunction against the pattern.
Steve, you mentioned something that in Saginaw, when you were trying to organize Wilcox Ridge, that the business agent Linwood Smith was brought before a certain board and they pressed charges against him.
Well, he wasn't business agent then. At that time, we hadn't entered into the Pattermakers League. That was in 1941. And he was the regional director of the UAW, Region 1D. We had had trouble over at the Wilcox Ridge plant, that is, in organizing them. That was at the Homer Martin UAW split, Homer Martin John L. Lewis split. And we had been told that if we could hold that Saginaw place out for a couple of days, that then these places in Marshall, which they had plants in Marshall and Detroit, would go out too, in more or less sympathy. And we had had trouble there for a couple of weeks, and then they had him brought before the courts. Is that what they do, Jerry? And he was put under contempt. He was charged later with contempt of court. He was forbidden to go near there. And on this time, when they did shut the plant down, which resulted in the state police coming, he was arrested and held in contempt of court. And then a riot ensued, and he was more or less blamed for that. And they
now,
had
the riot being what? This is the time that you overpowered the police?
That's the time that police were overpowered by the workers, yes, and driven back and kept away, and the state police came in to keep the peace about noon of that day.
And the state police used tear gas?
No, the city police used the tear gas. That is, after we'd driven the city police across the street, they used the tear gas. And then we threw the canisters of tear gas back at them, and then they retreated further back. They were a distance of maybe 2 blocks from us. And no, that was the closest that a policeman was to us. And then when the state police came with their machine guns and setting up barricades, we left.
Time to leave then.
Yeah, it was time to leave.
What was the final outcome on Linwood Smith? These charges were pressed?
Oh, they were, yes. They were pressed. He was indicted. He was the only one of that group that was indicted, and they were letting it hang. And the UAW, the top UAW, says, well, it'll die a natural death. Smithy says, look, I get elected to this job every 2 years. Take care of it. I don't want that death to be mine in jail. So they went. I think Judge Murphy was the oldest judge in the state at that time. He had the right to appoint any judge, you know, that to hear it, something on that. Or so he says, I'll appoint myself. And then about 2 weeks later, he says, I dismiss the charges.
Is this the same Judge Murphy who...
No, this is Judge Murphy in Detroit. He was at that time the that I think they call it, I don't know what they do call it, the reigning judge or the, he had the judge with the most seniority, and he more or less was entitled to, on those districts there, to appoint a judge. He appointed himself.
This is not the same Murphy who becomes the governor?
Oh, no.
No, it's different Murphy.
Different Murphy.
Because Governor Murphy also was somewhat on the side of unionism.
Oh,
he supports a great deal.
If it wasn't for Governor Murphy, the UAW, I don't think, would be in existence.
He was governor when they had the sit-down strike
in
Flint,
right.
Yes.
And he didn't call the troops out, and if it hadn't been for him, if the UAW would be in existence, it would be at a delayed date, because they threw everything on the line at that time.
As I recall, they were instructed not to do any shooting.
Yeah, that's the thing. He didn't send the troops in.
All right, in 1932, we left the repression stage, and we went into the encouragement phase. This was with the Norris-LaGuardia Act, and it made Yellow Dog contracts unenforceable, and it made injunctions more difficult to obtain. As applied to the Pattern Makers League, was this mere rhetoric, or did these tactics actually take place? You've explained before that you didn't really run into any Yellow Dog contracts. Now, the injunction process, was there ever an injunction process used against the PML?
I didn't say that I didn't run into Yellow Dog contracts. I said that I ran into, that I assume they're the same, company union contracts, which are Yellow Dog contracts, which it never bothered me any that I did run into them, because as soon as I can convince the employees that this wasn't the contract for them, they wasn't binding at all, which you just stated in the law.
I see. So really, this didn't much have much emphasis until 1935.
Well, I wasn't the district secretary until 46.
Okay, well, we'll lead up to that very quickly. In 1935, after the Supreme Court had ruled the NIRA unconstitutional, the National Labor Relations Act was founded. This is the Wagner Act, or Labor's Magna Carta. And it did a number of things, some of which that it prohibited anti-union discrimination, and it outlawed company unions. It forbade employees from interfering with union formation. It outlawed discrimination against workers filing charges. It obligated employers to bargain in good faith. In fact, organized labor grew from 4 million in 1935 to 15 million in 1947. How did this affect the growth of the Pattern Makers League?
Well, I would assume it didn't affect the growth of the Pattern Makers League nearly as much as it did a lot of other places. However, it did help us a lot. In fact, as I said before, I didn't start organizing until 1946, but a lot of these things tied right in with it. And I at least tried to use all of these things in my organizing. When a while ago, some strong-arm tactics were used in organizing. Well, when I took over organizing in 1946, this never entered into...
Oh, that was a thing of the past.
It was a thing of the past. It never entered into my policy in organizing at all. And as far as injunctions you mentioned a while ago, the only injunctions that I recall was injunctions I got against companies by going to the courts. If the companies wouldn't listen to me to teach them a lesson, I'd have to take them to court to learn it the hard way.
I see.
And this is what I would inform
them
Otto before
Scoble,
I did it.
Otto Scoble had a shop in Saginaw, and his league struck them at one time, and he had an injunction. He had an injunction.
Oh, I recall
before,
that,
remember?
Too. Around early 1940s.
Uh-huh.
That was the old Wolverine Pattern shop.
No.
No, that Wolverine was owned by...
Paul Bernier.
Well, what was the name? Was it Mercury?
I would say Mercury.
Mercury
close,
Pattern.
Mercury Pattern down on Hamilton.
Yes.
And they had the injunction served on him, too, because he was also a member, remember?
Yeah.
That they were forbidden to... let's say, I don't think they ever did organize that shop, and he's dead now.
You mean Stovall or...
Yeah.
Otto. Otto Stovall, but I'm trying to think of the other fellow who run the shop afterwards. Anyway, I talked to him one of the... couple of years before I retired.
Uh-huh.
I think I could have gotten a shot then. I was in his office one day, and very, very congenial with me.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, he's made a lot different. Otto was the chairman of the bargaining committee at the foundry at one time.
I usually went into a shop, talked to the management to find out just how... A lot of times I talked to the management before I talked to the men to find out what I'm going to run into there.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, if possible, I could sign a shop up by getting the management to agree to it. But when the management tell me, well, you'll have to organize my men, okay, that's all I wanted to find out.
You mentioned that you had to, on occasion, get injunctions against the companies. The question was, how much difficulty did you have in insisting that companies abide by the tenets of the National Labor Relations Act? Did you have a tough time forcing the companies to live to the letter of the law?
There were companies, and I've particularly encountered this in 1964 and 65 when I set up a new association out in Warren, Michigan. These companies had never been organized and encountered a lot of stiff opposition. And when we set up a charter out there, the first person who was elected business manager when we set up the charter, and he was a very prominent person in their shop, it wasn't too long afterwards he was fired. And that's not the only instance, but several other shops, the people who were active in the union were fired. But I used this as a very good organizing tool because I filed unfair labor practices against the shop and got and the first two that were fired and got a very favorable ruling on it. And I think one of them received $1,100 in back pay and the other one close to that amount. I don't remember the exact amount. But this was very good organizing material because I had copies of these decisions made and passed them around to the shops, letting the other companies know that they just can't do that anymore. And after two or three, not only the first two, I had a few other filings, but they never amounted to anything. I mean, as soon as the company knew that I was going to file unfair labor charges, they made some kind of way of restitution. They didn't want to go through with it. Just the first two people that were fired, this cured them. I mean, for all the companies, really.
Well, you hit that pocketbook, you know, that's what bothers them, the whole deal.
I advised some of these people. I know we had such a good case, I advised them to take a vacation.
Yeah.
That's good advice. All right, in 1936, John L. Lewis and sympathizers withdrew and were simultaneously expelled from the AFL because of their insistence upon industrial unionism. What impact did the formation of the CIO have upon the PML?
Your first statement about the, of course, the AFL, as originally organized, with a group of skilled craft people, really. And then when they brought in the industrial unions, there became quite a conflict of interest there as far as the American Federation of Labor is concerned. And so far as an impact on the Pattern Makers League, I don't recall that it had any on it, except that when they started organizing in these plants, we had to be on the ball to, wherever we could, separate our people from the industrial union.
We
were successful in doing it in many, many instances, but there were a few places that we had to go in afterwards and do the job over in order to get them. And as we mentioned a while ago, one place they voted for the Pattern Makers League, we were entitled to do that by in the Labor Relations Act, I believe, originally.
At that time, right. You could pick your shop. And it come out, and I think Lynch said it was the American Can decision that we had to now, in a corporation, you had to vote all the pattern makers in the corporation. But,
I'm not sure about, I heard so much about the American Can, and right now I've forgotten exactly what it is.
Yeah. But we do know that we can't pick like a shop as Malavalian, we couldn't get them alone. We'd have to take other shops, too, at General Motors.
Now, what you're talking about, Harold, didn't come about that I was